Good afternoon, everyone. I'm calling the House Education Finance Committee to order. And welcome to all of our guests here today. We do have a quorum, so we'll go ahead and proceed. And let's see, Representative Anzos, if you had a chance to thoroughly review the minutes and move their approval.
The minutes are perfectly done. I moved them.
Very well. Representative Anzos has moved adoption of the minutes from our meeting yesterday. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, the minutes are approved. Thank you, Representative Anzos. And as I indicated, we're taking some time here in one of our first hearings to allow presentations by any organizations that have interest in the education of our children that want to present testimony. And we will be, again, limiting testifiers to 5 minutes. We've got some cards prepared, so I think at the four-minute mark, we'll try to flash and let you know you've got about a minute to wrap up. You don't have to take the full 5 minutes if you don't want to our testifiers, but this is just to try to keep it fair to everyone that nobody's going to get more than 5 minutes. So, and to the members of the committee, you know, many of the points that are going to be raised by some of our presenters today will be things that we will have hearings on and discuss in more detail. So I'd appreciate it if you have just a clarifying question or something you want to ask of our testifiers, that's fine, but we won't debate what's being proposed today, just to give as much opportunity for as many people to testify before the committee today as possible. If we could proceed in that fashion, I think we would all we'll get as many people to express their views as possible today. So with that, I think we will go ahead and get started, unless Representative Murphy, I will just make it my tradition at the beginning of any of our meetings to offer you an opportunity if there's any comments or anything you wanted to share before we get rolling.
Madam Chair, excuse me. Would you start again, please?
Yes. I just said at the beginning of most of our hearings, it will be my practice before we start with our testimony, just to see if you had any comments or anything you wanted to share with the committee.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I will be prepared for the future.
Very well.
That means I have to be on time every time.
We will allow a little latitude for you, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will do better. But I just learned lots yesterday, and I'm impressed at the commitment that committee members are making, that have made in the past, and with their expertise, and I am envious about their expertise.
We are all learning as this process goes along, aren't we? Thank you. All right. All right. Well, very well. We will go ahead and then begin with our presentations by our testifiers, and a number of organizations have let us know that they would like to testify, so I've got a list of them in no particular order, so I'm just going to go down my list and call you up, and I'll kind of read ahead a little bit so you know you're either, you know, at bat or on deck or whatever the appropriate baseball terms are here for doing this. So, I have Intermediate School Districts, John Christensen, Superintendent, and then behind them, Charter School Partnerships, if Mr. Sweeney is here, and then also Charter School Association, Eugene Piccolo. So, all right, and welcome to our testifiers, and if you would please state your name for the record, and then please proceed.
Chair Loon, members of the committee, thank you so much for the opportunity to present before you this afternoon. My name is John Christensen, and I'm superintendent of the Intermediate School District 917, and I'm here to speak to two of our 2015 legislative initiatives. They are ALC, or Alternative Learning Center, per student funding and facility funding. All three intermediate districts serve students who enroll in our area learning center programs. Such enrollment is allowed by statutes permitting choice for students who are not succeeding in their traditional systems and meet any of the 12 graduation incentives criteria, such as mental health issues, homelessness, difficulties with academic performance, or limited English proficiency. In my school district, we provide programs to approximately 200 full-time alternative learning center students who are disproportionately students of color, students of poverty, and students with special education needs. They also include students who are pregnant and parenting teens, involved with the juvenile justice system, have truancy issues, and many come to us with average literacy at the fourth grade level. In short, they are the students who have fallen through the cracks and at the heart of the achievement gap and are at risk of not graduating from high school. Current revenue sources for intermediate ALC programs are designated by Minnesota school finance laws. The result is that students who attend our intermediate programs have revenue support which is significantly less than the state and regional average when compared to ALCs operated by K-12 districts. We receive approximately $1,200 less than the statewide average for K-12 districts. A combination of ALC statutes and changes in funding statutes in 2013 and 14 have resulted in significantly less revenue for students who attend our ALCs, with the majority of students being Minnesota's most at risk. As education and policy leaders, we must understand our current funding statutes are not equitable and potentially violate a student's fundamental right to an adequate education. As leaders, we cannot justify that the most needy students are provided 20% less revenue than the average K-12 school district ALC student. We are seeking your support of legislation that will be introduced to provide a new revenue source for Area Learning Center students who choose to enroll in programs offered by the intermediate school districts and our outstate joint powers counterparts, such as service cooperatives and education districts. The three intermediate districts look forward to providing more testimony on this important legislation and seek your understanding and support. The second issue in our legislative platform that I'll briefly describe is the need of your support for long-term facility needs, our long-term facility needs. The 2013 legislature directed convening a K-12 facilities working group that developed recommendations for the legislature, which we support. The intermediates want to bring two recommendations to your attention. Recommendation one combines current K-12 levy authority for alternative facilities, deferred maintenance, and health and safety revenue into a new long-term facilities maintenance revenue program. We currently don't have the alternative facilities or deferred maintenance authority. The intermediates currently have authority for health and safety revenue through our member districts, and we need to have this revenue source continue. We bring this to your attention so our needs are not overlooked as the details of creating a new combined facilities maintenance revenue are considered. We would also ask, as the implementation details are considered for Working Group Recommendation 4, establishing a new schools improvement levy program to replace the current building lease levy, that our needs, again, are not overlooked. We need to have the school facilities improvement levy revenue source equal to the current intermediate lease levy authority maintained, and we need the allowable uses to be the same as our member districts. Thank you for your time as to present our interest.
Thank you, Mr. Christensen. Representative Newton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Christensen, what grades do the intermediate districts serve?
We serve primarily kindergarten through 12th grade students, but we do have a lot of services for disabled students who can include preschool students.
Thank you.
And Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are there any intermediates that still do any Volk Tech for people that have dropped out of high school, or even some that I think have graduated?
We do career and technical programs for secondary students from our member districts. Typically, those are juniors and senior students who come to our facilities for a portion of their day to participate in a career and tech program. So we don't serve post-secondary students. Those who are attending our schools need to be enrolled in a school district to attend.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Christensen, how are you governed, or how are you ruled, or how are you, who decides what is being served to your members?
Okay. We were created by legislative action in the late 90s, early 70s. The member districts choose to join in a joint powers arrangement with the intermediate. We're governed by a board of education, with each member district appointing a member to our board. and we are governed by many of the same statutes as K-12 districts in the state of Minnesota.
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Mr. Christensen, that board then from one person from each of your school districts, are they members of the school district that's sending their students to the intermediate district?
Mr. Christensen.
Our bylaws indicate that they have to be a citizen of their district, and in my case, I have 9 member districts, and 7 of them are seated school board members on their school board. 2 are former school board members who were appointed by the school board to be their representative. And that can be different from intermediate to intermediate.
Representative Murphy.
And Madam Chair, I was reading very quickly how you were funded. And does the school board, the intermediate board, then create services that can be provided with the idea that they are going to bring more students to the intermediate district from the local school district?
Mr. Christensen.
Yep. The statute says that our primary mission is low incident special education services and career and technical secondary services, or any other services that our board requests that we provide for member district students.
Representative Murphy.
I think I'll read the statute.
There's several.
Thank you. And Representative Detmer, you had a question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Christensen, is there a cost of membership for the school districts?
Mr. Christensen.
The 3 intermediate districts have different governing structures. 2 of the districts have a core fee that it's called, in addition to the tuition and charges for the service of the students. In my particular intermediate, we don't have the core fee, so it's a matter of the tuition and cost being shared among the members.
Yeah, and Madam, a follow-up, Madam Chair, and Mr. Christensen, how are these services provided? I know, is there students that move from one school to the next, or are there instructors moving from one school to the next? Is there open enrollment involved here?
It's a combination. Students that we serve generally have to be residents and enrolled in their member district, school district. We have what are called Setting 4 services, which are all-day center-based services for very high-need special education students, and those are served in facilities that are standalone, not associated with a member district. We also do then itinerant services such as physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy. Many of those people will travel to the member district school or site to deliver those services to students. And then we are also co-located in some of the member district's buildings. In our case, we have approximately 20 different programs that are either like at Lakeville North High School or at a middle school in Farmington or a elementary school in Burnsville, that type of thing. So it's a combination of our sites, shared sites, and then travel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Detmer. And I know there may be more questions on that, and it indicates to me a high level of interest in knowing more about the intermediate district. So I'm noting that, and we will be sure to incorporate that into a future hearing. So with that, I would like to move on to our next testifier just so we can get to hear from as many people as possible today. So thank you, Mr. Christensen. We appreciate your testimony. And Mr. Sweeney, if you would go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, and please proceed.
Chair Loom, committee members, my name is Brian Sweeney, and I'm with a charter support organization called Charter School Partners. We're 5 years old. Our mission is to increase the number of high-performing charter schools in Minnesota and to increase the number of high-performing charter schools serving low-income kids in Minnesota. We do that with 3 initiatives. One, we have a Charter Start support organization in which we help new charter schools or existing charter schools expand, and we get pretty deep with some of these schools. The 11 new charter schools that have opened in Minneapolis over the last 3 years, we've been very much involved with all of those in a variety of capacities, in identifying leadership and leadership development, board development, financial startup support, and facility. Our second initiative to reach our goal of assisting in closing the opportunity gap is we brought together 30 charter schools in the Twin Cities. We call them a community of excellence, and all committed to a high-performing charter sector and charter community. And we get together on a regular basis, and we talk about best practices and how our schools can get better. Our third initiative to achieve our goal is the policy initiatives, which is the reason I'm here today. And it's to support our mission and to support the high-performing charter. We have four policy goals. We've had them for 4 years. They include equitable charter financing, increasing future pipeline for all public schools, improving the quality of the charter sector, particularly empowering authorizers to have more authority to address the lowest performing charters. And our fourth goal is a district charter collaborative. We support MACS's legislative initiatives, and we sometimes have just a different focus on a couple of the issues. We share the issue of equitable charter financing. We hope to add to that conversation in the next week. We're going to release a report by Clifton Larson Allen that does a disparity analysis between districts and charters. And I think it's going to say that there is a disparity statewide, approximately 10%. And in the two large school districts, it's substantially more, over 20% in St. Paul and 30% in Minneapolis. So we hope that'll add to the discussion of how district and charter schools are funded. Secondly, for several years we've been very much supportive of the alt-cert legislation and getting experienced teachers, particularly teachers of color, and particularly those who have served low-income schools in other states to have a greater ability to get here and to add to our teacher corps. Three, we have begun a discussion within the charter community. We haven't always agreed on this one, but the goal is to empower authorizers to move more quickly in dealing with the chronically lowest performing charter schools. And I'm not talking about ALC-like schools, like the High School for Recording Arts. They are doing the work of the Lord, and they need to continue to do that work without interference from the outside. So what we're talking about, and sometimes it's the elephant in the room, or the donkey in the room, depending on which side of the aisle you're on, that there is a sector of the charter community and school that aren't doing well. And I think we have to have an honest discussion on how we address those schools. Finally, we have had a district charter collaborative. We work closely with the Office of New Schools in Minneapolis. We were very supportive of the 2013 legislation, which added to the charter law a district charter collaborative effort. And we've seen the first fruits of that this year. Hiawatha Academies and MPS have actually entered into a collaborative agreement. And I think we can see that with other schools in Minneapolis, as well as outside. I know Forest Lake has a great collaborative between LILA, the language immersion. Can you help me? LILA, and that works very closely. Lakes International Language Academy. That works very closely with the district. So thank you again for the opportunity to be part of this.
All right, thank you, Mr. Sweeney. And so I have a Representative Dabney has a question.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I might be two. In terms of the charter schools that you work with, Minnesota School of Science came into Minneapolis a few years ago, was brought in by the school district because it was a high-performing charter school in other areas. Ran into some problems, particularly they refused to enroll special education students.
Yep.
And they apparently did so stating publicly that it would undermine their performance numbers, and that Their goal was high performance numbers, and one of their strategies for achieving that was to not accept special education students. They were renting from Minneapolis Public Schools, and the school district ended the lease, and Minnesota School of Science left town. Right. Was that one of the schools the Charter School Partners was
It actually
at?
Wasn't.
Okay.
Mr. Sweeney.
So yes or no question, I guess.
Mr. Sweeney.
Chair Loon, Representative Dabney, it was not. We were very concerned about some of the same issues. Mm-hmm. There was an agreement between MPS and that school to take on special ed students. They did not do that. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you're not going to talk about the 11 successful launches that we've had here, but that was one that, you know, was problematic, and they did not live up to their end of the agreement.
Madam Chair, another question.
Representative Dabney.
In terms of the funding equity, we do know that some of the highest funded per pupil schools in the state are charter schools. Can you speak to the committee on what community education responsibilities charter schools carry, what ECF, early childhood family education, what early childhood special education services charter schools provide in the communities they're located in?
Chair Loon, Representative Dabney, that's about four questions. But
it's the way we roll around here.
I'm not sure I necessarily agree that the charter schools have some of the highest funding per student. I don't agree with that.
Mr. Sweeney, in fact, I'm gonna let you off the hook here, and I'm going to ask Mr. Strom or Ms. Johnson if for our next meeting, I know that they have charts, and they can prepare that from highest to lowest and include all of our districts as well as our charter schools. So I'll ask that to be prepared for the committee. So you can move on to the next question then.
Madam Chair, just to be fair to Mr. Sweeney, the community education responsibilities the charter schools carry, the early childhood family education services they provide, yep, and the early childhood special education services that they provide to the communities that they're located in.
Chair Loon.
Mr. Sweeney.
Representative Dabney, as you may know, the charter community movement could assist with this, has approximately the same percent of special ed students as district, about 12 to 14%. And we are charter school partners, part of the Many Minds Coalition, and we're very supportive of encouraging all our charter schools to have a pre-K program. And so I don't know if that answers partially a couple of your questions.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. And Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Sweeney, for your testimony. We always hear a lot of stories around here, and I would like to hear one success story. Could you highlight one that you have for the committee?
Mr. Sweeney.
Chair Loon, Representative, each year the Star Tribune lists the beating the odds schools that are assisting the highest low income populations of low income schools, and 8 out of the 10 schools every year are charter schools. Harvest Network of Schools in North Minneapolis, Hiawatha Academies in South Minneapolis, which now has up to 4 schools, Global Academy, which is on the other side of Minneapolis, but has much more than, I think, 60 to 70% of Minneapolis students that are just hitting it out of the ballpark as far as closing the achievement gap. That's just one, I think, success story. There are so many different types of charter schools. The St. Paul Conservatory for Performing Artists here in downtown St. Paul is just a remarkable program. They serve 38 different students from 38 different districts, and you know, there's a lot of great success stories.
Thank you, Representative Detmer.
And I'm going
to ask the last question before we move on.
It's not really quick. It's just a comment. The Lila Lakes International Academy Language Academy, which is in my community, mm-hmm, and toured that facility. In fact, they just built a brand new school this year for the for certain grade levels. Nice. And also North Lakes Academy, that's another charter school that we have in our district. And the public school and the charter schools, they're working together. I know the Spanish immersion and Chinese immersion, now the public school is also offering those courses, so kids can go from the Lila International Language Academy and they can take continue on with the end of the junior high and the other schools. So it's a great program.
Some very innovative programs out there. All right. Thank you very much, and thank you, Mr. Sweeney. Mr. Piccolo, welcome. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Eugene Piccolo, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools. The association was started back in about 3 years after the charter school law was enacted in Minnesota back in 1991, and we are a membership organization made up of schools. It's a voluntary organization, and just being passed around to you is a primer on charter schools. This year there are 157 charter schools operating in the state of Minnesota, enrolling over 45,000 public school students. There's some information about the basics about what a charter is, and then on the back side of that sheet there's some demographic information. For example, last year we had 1.5 times the state average in terms of students receiving free and reduced lunch, so about 55% of our total student population received free and reduced. 25% of our students were English language proficient, limited English language proficiency, and we had 51% of our students were minority students across the state. And you can see the different kinds of programs there are, and some issues about the geographic distribution. We have charter schools from Grand Portage in the far northeast part of the state to Echo, Minnesota in the southwest, from La Crescent in the southeast to 3 schools in Bemidji, Minnesota. So they're all over the place. Most schools are in the metropolitan area. As I mentioned, we are a membership organization. And our membership, you can read on the other sheet, is our mission is to advocate for charter school policies that support innovation, quality, and accountability, facilitate cooperation among the community, charter school community, to assure excellence in education for our students. So one of the areas we focus on is leadership development, both at the board level and at the school administrator level, because we have come to, because governance is a hybrid in charter schools. They are nonprofit organizations running a public institution, and so it's a very unique model of governance that has to take place there. So that's one of our focus areas. In terms of our public policy, you can see we have a platform in 10 areas of issues, and I just want to speak a couple of issues around finances and facilities since this is the Finance Committee. Number one priority is to provide equitable funding for students who attend charter schools. One of the areas that students in charter schools do not get funding for is the small school revenue, and also we are looking at direct funding for extended year programs, which students in charter schools do not get. So charter schools do really have had a difficult time providing summer school and other kinds of programs. Second is provide charter schools with funding to meet the health and safety requirements. Charter schools by law must meet all federal, state, and local health and safety requirements, but we do not get any health and safety referendum or levy monies. Third, to require that when there are local operating levies, that they include charter schools and that the money then follow that student to the appropriate public school of their choice, whether it's another public school in another district or a charter school. And then in terms of facilities, this has been one area that charter schools have struggled enormously since the very beginning, because our law basically says that charter schools cannot own a building if they use public funds. So all charter schools lease space. Some have created affiliated building companies over the years, which were approved by this legislature 4 years ago. But it is an awkward and expensive way of doing business, and so we would like to see the legislature really tackle the issue of charter school facilities by allowing direct ownership and then creating a funding mechanism for bonding for facilities. And we will have a bill coming forward for that issue, because it's probably the weakest area of our whole law. And our law is considered the best charter school in the country because of the autonomy and the accountability systems that are built into it. So there are a number of other areas that we have issues. And we'll know they'll be coming up through the policy committee and then to this committee. We'll talk about those later. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Piccolo, the last point that you made, could you give us a little more in that? The bonding, you want state bonding?
Mr. Piccolo.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, what we're proposing is that, first of all, charter schools be allowed to own buildings directly, mm-hmm. that a state bonding authority be created, kind of like the higher education authority for selling of bonds for higher education facilities. They would not be the full faith and credit of the state of Minnesota because they'd be revenue bonds, because the lease aid that schools generate would go to pay those bonds.
Okay. All right.
Thank you for that clarification.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, Mr. Preckle. I appreciate your testimony. And all right, I'm going to call down the next three that I have on my list. Minnesota Rural Education Association and Service Cooperatives, Ignite Minnesota, and MinCAN. All right, looks like we've got you ready first, Mr. Walseth. So whenever you're ready, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Okay, thank you. Madam Chair, members, my name is Sam Walseth. I'm the Director of Legislative Action for the Minnesota Rural Education Association. What's being handed out is a packet of basically maps. We believe that pictures can tell 1,000 words. And trying to put complex educational data in front of you in a snapshot to show some different trends across the state is a easier way than trying to page through 12 or 15 different pages of line item spreadsheets. In anticipation of a few questions, Madam Chair, MREA is governed by a board of directors that is comprised of elected school board officials, school administrators, and teachers. And then we also have higher education agency members, two positions for that. Two service cooperative agency positions on the governing board, and one position for education districts, which is a particular statute on the books as well. Together, there's about 21 board members. We do divide the state into four governance regions, a north, a north central, a south central, and a south region, so that our membership has members on the governing board from all parts of the state. The belief, the mission of the Minnesota Rural Education Association is to put learners first. It's a unique model in that we believe that all players in rural education need to be at the table discussing the, education finance and policy issues in order to advance the mission of putting learners first and advancing education. I think there was a question, too, from yesterday. I wasn't here, Madam Chair, but about dues structures that the committee was interested in. Our dues structure is there's a base rate for membership districts at $1,100 per district and then $1 per pupil, and that rate is capped at $2,500 per district. So a minimum amount, if you're a one-student district, you'd pay $1,101, and the largest districts are capped at $2,500. And together, that puts together our budget. We have about 198 member districts. The first map that you have shows our district, our members across the state of Minnesota. We're very proud of our district membership and the growth we've had up to 198 members. What I would note is that while that looks like it's covering a lot of the state of Minnesota, those member districts comprise 185,000 students out of Minnesota's 850 or so thousand students. So we have a lot of very small, geographically smart, sparse districts in the state. My average district size is about 900 or 950 or so districts. So, Madam Chair, in anticipation of some of those questions, I wanted to answer those. If you look at the second page in the packet, you've got a map showing voter-approved referendum levels in 2013 before the last biennium's education finance and tax bills passed. And there's a pattern of inequity that existed, and we brought that to the committee's last the last biennium, and the legislature responded. You can see that the darker color districts were the ones with the 0 to 300 or less amount of referendum authority. Those are the ones that, in Mr. Strom's presentation, moved on to, you know, were able to adopt that local optional revenue. And then the second chart is, the next chart on the next page is showing the 5th to 95th gap. I wanted to highlight the huge reduction in that 5th to 95th gap in the wake of that action. We're very proud of that work that was done. The next map shows the pattern of free and reduced student body across Minnesota. We often talk about poverty in the urban core. We certainly struggle with poverty throughout rural Minnesota. You can see the districts and see the pattern of free and reduced. The next map in the packet is shows medium household income by district, and there's a large spread of an average of 21,000 household income in Pine Point all the way up to 105,000 in Minnetonka. So you can see the spread of household income. So we actually know where those silk stocking districts are and those wool stocking districts are, Madam Chair. And then the last two maps, you were alluding to adjusted net tax capacity and referendum market value. And you can see the spread of property wealth per pupil for those two tax bases, and we'll talk more about that in the future. I'm getting a signal here. It's hard to keep it all into about 5 minutes, but our top priorities coming this session, Madam Chair and members, are advancing the facilities task force recommendations, expanding early childhood opportunities through what we call the school readiness statute. We don't believe a scholarship-only model is sufficient. And last but not least is returning the teaching profession to the attractive profession that it once was, and being able to hire and retain those teachers. We struggle with teacher shortages in rural Minnesota. So, Madam Chair, hope to talk to you at more length throughout the session, but that's my short story for today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Walseth, and you got a lot into your 5 minutes, so I appreciate that. All right, and our next testifier, I believe, is from Ignite Minnesota. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Carrie Dennison-Kanine, and I'm the Executive Director of Ignite After School. I want to thank you so much for this opportunity to share with you more information about the power of after school to help us really achieve our shared and collective goals to address the achievement gap and ensure that young people are prepared for the 21st century workforce. I want to start a little bit by sharing a little bit about Ignite After School. We are Minnesota's after school network. We're in our 11th year, and we have a mission to increase access to high-quality after-school programs for all young people in every community across the state. We do this by building partnerships, by advancing policy, and also by increasing quality of after-school programs. We are a diverse network. We're a statewide network. I wanted to share a little bit about who our partners are. We work with after-school program providers, such as the Twin Cities Boys and Girls Clubs, citywide intermediaries like the Northfield Healthy Community Initiative, foundations like the Northland Foundation in Northeast Minnesota, state agencies, as well as as statewide associations like the Statewide Association of YMCAs. Also, I wanted to share a little bit about how we define after school. We're focusing on programs that are very intentional and that take place outside the school day. So we're talking about before school, after school, and summer. And also programs that offer a wide range of experiences. These could be small group tutoring sessions. This could be agricultural programs for young people to after-school robotics clubs. And they happen in a range of places, from schools to community centers to libraries. What we are asking during this legislative session is to consider $50 million of new funding over the 16-17 biennium for competitive grants administered by the Minnesota Department of Education. We propose that the funding serve primarily low-income youth. We really want to target young people who are at most risk of experiencing an opportunity gap, really targeting young people who are impacted by the achievement gap. We also want to guarantee distribution of those resources across the state, both Greater Minnesota as well as in the metro. And we want to target programs that are intentional about building 21st century skills, supporting school success, and helping young people on their path to college and careers. We estimate that this would impact and provide opportunities to about 50,000 young people over the biennium. So I also wanted to share a little bit, and you'll see in your packet there's a handout that talks about some of the research around after school. And the research is exciting because it's showing that it's not just nice, but that it actually delivers and helping us to address the achievement gap and other opportunity gaps that young people face. So some of this research shows that if young people participate in high-quality after-school programs and they participate regularly in the elementary school years, it can close the achievement gap by grade 5 in math achievement. There's also some research that shows not only does it impact core academics, but also improves behavior in school as well as attendance. So we know that participation really matters. We know that it has strong outcomes. But we don't make the investments necessary to ensure that it's working for Minnesota. The Minnesota Department of Education has been publishing the out-of-school time funding streams report since 2008. And this report shows that over the last 6 years, we've lost about a third of the funding for after-school programs in Minnesota. So this equals about $11.4 million. The disinvestment in after-school programs has cut young people's access to high-quality opportunities. We also, if you look at some really interesting data from the Minnesota Student Survey, you can see that about 50% of low-income students participate in after-school programs at least 3 times a week or less. So it shows about a 19% gap when compared to higher-income students. So given the research, given the gap that exists between low-income students and higher-income students, we're really would love to talk with you more this session about the role that after-school can play as a strategy in our efforts to close the achievement gap. And I want to thank you so much for your time to share this information with you today.
Thank you, Ms. Dennison. Is it Cunningham?
Kineen.
Very good. Thank you. One quick question I had for you. So your funding for after-school programs, is that almost always state-funded? Is it a combination of state and private funds? Or how would you characterize funding for your programs?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, after school is funded in many diverse ways. There is a federal funding source administered by the Minnesota Department of Ed, the 21st Century Community Learning Centers grant. There are a few funding streams that the state provides, although they're not targeted to after school. And there's also private funding as well through foundations and others, as well as fee-based opportunities.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Anderson had a question.
Thanks, Madam Chair. These programs, after school and summer learning, are they staffed or run by certified teachers, or who does these jobs?
Representative, Madam Chair, members of the committee, sometimes they are staffed by licensed teachers, but not always. There's a diverse workforce, and there's many professional development opportunities that really go to supporting those staff to ensure that they're providing high-quality opportunities.
Thank you. And Representative Bennett had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just curious, are these most of your programs held on-site at the schools? Are they off-site? Where do you hold those?
Representative Bennett, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the after-school programs happen in a variety of places. So some of them do happen at schools. Sometimes community-based organizations provide programs in the school building. They also happen in a variety of other community sites, like a library, like a community center, like a Boys and Girls Club. So it's a diverse range.
Oh, Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering, you cited a study, I think I heard correctly, that shows that these after-school programs can close the achievement gap by fifth grade in math. Is that right? Is there a link you can provide for us, send on to the committee where we could look at the studies?
Representative, Madam Chair. Yes, you should have a handout that talks about that particular study. It's the very first chart on the other side, if you flip it over, the Deborah Vendel study. And I can also provide that more information about that study if
thank you.
Interested.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Yes, if you could pass that along to the committee, that would be appreciated. Thank you. All right, so thank you very much for your testimony, and we will next move to a representative from MNCAN. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Yes, Madam Chair, members, my name is Joshua Crossan, and I'm with MNCAN. MNCAN stands for Minnesota's Campaign for Achievement Now, and we're an education advocacy nonprofit, really working to improve public education from early learning to 12th grade for all kids, regardless of their zip code, background, race, ethnicity, et cetera. At MNCAN, we have two major policy priorities. One comes from a report from the National Council on Teacher Quality, and also from a poll recently done. The Senate recently had a hearing that had Teachers of the Year, National and State Teachers of the Year, and really asked them, what are you guys doing well? What do we need to do to encourage teachers like you and replicate teachers like you to get into the classroom? 80% of them said we need to improve our clinical experience program and for all incoming teachers. So MNCAN supports, for the clinical experience, just to kind of explain what that is, When a new teacher comes into the classroom, they first have to do about 10 weeks unpaid, almost like an internship. Right now, there's no floor of what that quality looks like. So MinCAN supports having these conversations and policies that would create a floor of quality, not just the amount of time in the classroom, but also making sure that they're partnered with the teacher who's best equipped to have a student teacher. The second major policy comes from, at MinCAN, we spend a lot of time and resources visiting schools across Minnesota, speaking to thousands of administrators, teachers, community members, and we've heard time and time again that we need to improve our state licensing process. These processes need to be streamlined and modernized. And I want to start by telling you a story about Andrea, a teacher who recently moved to Minnesota. Andrea's been teaching math for about 10 years total. She comes from Texas and Massachusetts. In Massachusetts, her Boston students ranked number one in proficiency and growth in the entire state. She also has her master's in education from Harvard and is nationally certified. She moved back to Minnesota, her home state, and in 2011, she began to inquire about transferring her math license. Currently, she's teaching special ed in math. She's on her third and final year of a variance license, and the Board of Teaching hasn't given her any clear steps on how she can obtain a license. If she doesn't get a math license by the end of this school year, she plans to leave Minnesota and teach elsewhere. And my question to you are these really the teachers we want to block from Minnesota's borders? Are these really the people we want to keep out of our classrooms? And stories like Andrea's that are so prevalent, time and time again, we've heard constantly. And so at MinCAN, we really want to push a policy agenda that focuses on addressing five major problems. One, we need to address teacher shortages in greater Minnesota. We recently heard from the Minnesota Rural Education Association that teacher shortages are a real thing in greater and rural Minnesota. Dr. Clint Willard, I would like to quote from him. He's a superintendent from Brainerd, and he said recently, quote, "We're having a hard time filling classroom spaces. We need to fill that pipeline through streamlined pathways." Stories like these are all too prevalent, and we need to make that fix. Secondly, we need to fill hard-to-staff positions in large metropolitan schools. For example, Minneapolis Public Schools identified several bilingual teachers recently from Chicago. The school district was ready and set to hire these teachers, and those teachers from Chicago are ready and set to come to Minneapolis and teach Minneapolis Public School kids. Unfortunately, our onerous licensing laws prevented that from happening. Third, we need to empower principals to hire and retain the teachers that best meet the unique needs of their students. A school administrator recently testified from Hiawatha Schools, recently testified that his best teacher, hands down, is on his third and last year of variance degree. And unless he's willing to start from square one, he's going to lose his best teacher. It's baffling that teachers that prove themselves time and time again are kept from the classroom. And we need to make a clear pathway to ensure those teachers can obtain a standard license in Minnesota. Fourth, we need to address teacher diversity. We not only need to tap into the teachers from our border states, but we also need to look at historical black colleges and universities, large metropolitan areas, tribal colleges, and alternative certification programs that do have larger diversity a diverse teaching core than Minnesota. To give you an idea of Minnesota teachers here, we have 4% of our teachers are of color. 30% of our students are of color. That's a huge gap. Nationally, 18% of teachers are of color. So 18% nationally, 4% here in Minnesota. So that's something that we don't have to address. And lastly, we need to use data from actual teaching experiences, not just transcripts and syllabi. The Board of Teaching is really making teachers who've been teaching for 10, 20 years dig up syllabi and transcripts to prove that they're great teachers, rather than looking at years of evaluations, accolades, depths of knowledge, and pedagogy and student growth. I think these are the most important elements to determining whether or not a great teacher should be ready to teach in Minnesota. And with that, I'm eager to listen to and hear some of your questions, and look forward to working with you all in this next year.
All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. All right, I'm not seeing any other questions, but I'm sure we'll be hearing from you at future hearings. So thanks very
much. Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
All right, so next up I have Educators for Excellence, Students for Education Reform, and Somali Youth Association. So if any of those representatives are here, would like to come down.
Good
right. Welcome to the Finance Committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, and thank you for the opportunity for letting me testify in front of you today. My name is Taylor Reeb, and I teach 4th through 6th grade special education at Brightwater Montessori Elementary. We're a public charter in North Minneapolis. And I originally didn't intend to become a teacher. I studied other things in college, and throughout my studies, began having conversations with my peers and colleagues about the disparities and inequities that existed in our education system nationally and in Minnesota, and was fortunate to be able to utilize an alternative pathway to licensure, and became licensed and am now in my 5th year teaching special education. And along with teaching in the classroom, I'm also a member of Educators for Excellence, which is a teacher-led organization, and we work to elevate the teaching profession both here in Minnesota and across the nation by giving teachers, classroom teachers, a meaningful voice in the creation of policies that impact our career and our classrooms directly. So E4E, or Educators for Excellence, began in New York with a group of teachers who really wanted a stronger voice in shaping those policies that were going to impact their students. And these teachers, you know, started organizing around their common belief that the role of educators in creating policy was really important. So this idea kind of spread across the country, and now nationally and in Minnesota, we engage teachers through creating policy teams to write policy papers and have an impact in this way. And so far in Minnesota, we've convened 2 policy teams on QComp, or quality compensation, and on teacher diversity. So I was able to be a member of E4E's QComp policy team, and we met over the course of about 3 months to discuss best practices and similar programs around the country around teacher compensation and evaluation, to look at things that worked and things that showed results for students, and also work toward our goal of elevating the teaching profession. So after looking at all of this research, we published a paper with a series of recommendations around improving and strengthening QComp as it exists today in Minnesota. And all of those recommendations are laid out in this pink paper that you received. So I was also able to be a part of the state working group that worked to align teacher evaluation with QComp, and you should be receiving those recommendations from the working group about the middle of February. Some of the recommendations that our policy team in E4E came up with that we would like to focus on for this legislative session, first are around funding for QComp. We believe that teacher evaluation should be funded for all schools and districts in Minnesota, and whereas QComp was a voluntary program, since teacher evaluation is required for all schools, we think schools should receive adequate funding to implement this, and that QComp should remain an optional program for districts that want to provide a more holistic system of supports for teachers' development and evaluation. Because teacher evaluation is one component of QComp, we recognize its importance in statute as well as in implementation in schools, but believe that the other components of QComp, the alternative salary schedule, the performance pay, the career ladders for teachers, and the job-embedded professional development, are really critical to developing high-quality teachers and also providing effective evaluations so teachers can continue to improve. The second recommendation around quality compensation that we came up with was hard-to-staff flexibility. Right now, the performance pay part of the QComp law allows for individual goals, school goals, and a team-based goal for performance pay. We'd like to see an additional part of that so that schools can incentivize the highest quality teachers to come to their schools and to stay there. So hard-to-staff schools and hard-to-fill positions so that we can have the best teachers in front of all of our students. Our second policy team worked on teacher diversity, and that paper is actually in publication right now, and we would love to share copies with any members who are interested as soon as that's finalized. The 3 recommendations I just want to touch on quickly, because I know my time is running short, are alternative pathways, teacher prep accountability, and out-of-state licensure. With alternative pathways, we think that having multiple entry points into the teaching profession is really critical to making sure we provide the opportunity for people who will be high-quality teachers to enter the classroom, not just people who decided when they're 17 to go through 17 or 18 to go through a traditional teacher prep program to enter the classroom. For example, mid-career professionals or grow-your-own programs, like people who've been paraprofessionals in classrooms for much of their career. Lastly, I would just like to echo some of the things that Josh stated when he spoke for MNCAN about out-of-state licensure. Out-of-state, making a clear pathway for out-of-state candidates who have shown that they can get results for students in other states is a very important piece to making sure that we have the best teachers in front of all of our students here in Minnesota. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. And could I have you spell your last name just so I get it correctly for the record?
Sure. It's spelled R-U-B, just pronounced Reeb.
Reeb. Okay, very good.
Thank you.
And I would just ask, there weren't quite enough copies of your report for all members, so we'll talk with you afterwards, but if we could get a few extra copies so everyone could have one,
yes,
I appreciate
definitely.
That. And a quick question, when do you anticipate your report on teacher diversity to be available?
Within the next few weeks.
Wonderful, yes. Wonderful. And Representative Anzales, you had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I'd like to know how much this quality compensation piece of literature cost. I'd like to know what source of funds paid for it. And thirdly, I'd like to know if QComp is so wonderful, why don't you all just recommend and advocate for its universal funding to all districts?
Ms. Reeb.
So Educators for Excellence published this paper, our organization published this paper. We're a 501c3 organization, and we receive most of our funding from local foundations, from the Minneapolis Foundation, the St. Paul Foundation, the Bush Foundation, and then we also have some national support through our National Educators for Excellence, which is based out of New York, through the Gates Foundation and other sources. So that's how the paper was paid for. And then, I'm sorry, could you repeat your last question, please?
You advocate for the effectiveness of QComp, which is a voluntary program, and I just wonder why you wouldn't advocate for expanding it to all eligible districts.
Ms. Reeb.
Thank you. As a part of the state working group, we made the recommendation that teacher evaluation be fully funded for all districts at a similar level that QComp funding is provided right now, which would cost about $300 million over the biennium. And we think that that is already quite a big ask, and so would love to see additional funding that was previously part of the levy option for QComp to be available for schools that want to do more innovative things, like the alternative salary schedule and performance pay that many schools and districts are not committed to being able to do at this point. Also, one of the most important pieces of QComp was that the district and the unions had to agree on how to implement it, and both had to sign off. And so I think adding in the other things that QComp requires and making it a requirement for all districts could prove problematic. But if there was enough funding, we do see the benefits of including all five components of QComp in every school.
Thank you. All right. And members, just again, in February when that report is out and the teacher evaluations and the QComp system is released by the department, we will be having for sure a day of hearings and maybe more than that on it. So we will be discussing this issue at some length. So thank you. Representative Murphy, burning question, or can we move on to the next testifier?
Fine.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Chair and members.
All right. Students for Education Reform. All All right, welcome. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony when you're ready.
Thank you. Well, Chair Loon and the members of the committee, my name is Latasha Gandy, and I am the Managing Director for Students for Education Reform. Students for Education Reform is a nonprofit organization that organizes college students around the achievement gap. We use our personal stories to advocate for legislative change and bring awareness to our local communities. Today, I brought one of our student leaders here, Ramon Page, and Ramon is going to discuss an issue that our students have identified as a priority for this legislative session.
Thank you, Mr. Page. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Hello. My name is Ramon Page. I'm a sophomore studying political science at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. I'm also the president of the ESPR chapter at the U. I joined ESPR because I feel like I barely made it out of our current education system, and I've seen and had too many friends and family members fall through the cracks of the achievement gap. Minnesota has one of the worst achievement gaps in the country. Because of this gap, many students of color are not graduating from high school, and the ones that do are still not prepared for college and having to take remedial courses. And this is why we are here today. We're advocating for a bill that addresses the issue of remedial courses, because more than half of high school graduates that enter MINSCU the next year needed remediation in 2011. Over half of black graduates and almost half of the Latino graduates were forced into remediation compared to only 24% of white students. While this problem affects thousands of students across Minnesota, it has also affected me personally. The summer after I graduated high school, I started at Mankato. And that summer, prior to me starting at Mankato, I endured a six-week intensive program where I was required to enroll and pay for preparatory courses in areas including math and writing before I was admitted into college. Then I spent my first semester of college in remedial courses where I became even more frustrated. Already working through issues at home and outside of school to ensure that I graduated on time, it was difficult being told that my efforts in high school weren't good enough. Not to mention the financial burden of having to pay for remediation. Remediation, despite its intentions to prepare students for college, is built on a foundation of low expectations for students, like myself in high school. Then students are forced to foot the bill, and we're standing up and we're saying no. We can no longer suffer the consequences by the system failure. In our eyes, there's no better time than acting now. Thank you.
So right now in front of you guys, you should have a copy of a policy paper that our students wrote. They did all the research and also wrote the policy paper. And then also a one pager that they have created with possible solutions and some statistics about the problem. I, too, myself, was a student who was forced to take remedial courses. I graduated the top of my class from Arlington High School with a 4.2 GPA and took all AP courses, and then found myself enrolled in remedial courses. Like Ramon, the emotional burden is enough to deal with, to not only have to realize that you have to pay the cost to make up for something that you should have already gotten. It not only makes you feel like you don't belong there, but it makes you question your ability to be successful. It places a burden on the student and not everyone involved in the system. And this is greatly affected in MINSCU. And with MINSCU schools being the biggest problem, and they're outside in the rural areas as well, this is a Minnesota problem. So it's not just a MINSCU problem. We believe in MINSCU. We believe MINSCU wants to support every student that enters their doors, but they need the additional support to be able to provide that support to students. So we believe through passing a bill that will eliminate remedial courses and make them all prerequisite courses, to where a student can enter into a prerequisite model, receive their remediation and their college level material at the same time. They will not waste time and they will not waste money. They will be earning college credits towards their degree, and they will get the message from the system that we are here to support you at all costs, just like we supported you in K-12 through IEPs, essentially. This legislation also provides differentiated support and equitable support for all students, not only the ones who are just now exiting, but for the ones that decided college is my path and I want to go back to school and I want to be successful for my family. So I thank you guys for your time. We look forward to engaging with you guys on this issue all session. We're not going anywhere. We will be here. And we'll answer any questions you have at this time.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Gandy and Mr. Page, for your testimony. I do have a question from Representative Huam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you so much to the testifiers. Thank you. It's great to have you here. I like what you're doing. but I think we also need to extend it down into so we don't have students in the classroom now having to go through the remedial in the future. We need to fix this system, and I hope that we do have time in committee to address this so that the students don't have to go through this. Again, thank you so much.
All right, thank you. Representative Marquardt.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair, and appreciate the testimony. And I do want to remind members that one of the five major goals that every single district has to strive for under the new World's Best Workforce is making sure that every student is career and college ready. So I think, you know, we have the accountability now, and I think now that there's a strategic plan, there has to be a local focus on those type of things, will also go a long ways in reducing the number of students that need remedial help in college.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'd like to ask either of you, also piggybacking on what was just said, do you have a solution for what could occur while you were still in high school? Have you thought of that solution? I think Representative Quam and Representative Marquardt both alluded to those.
Okay. Ms. Gandy or Mr. Page, whoever wants to take that one.
Thank you, Chair Loan, Representative Erickson. We're hoping, from discussions with our students, we're hoping that the ACT plan explore, and excuse me if I quoted that wrong, but the ACT plan explore makes sure that a student is prepared with an adequate ACT score, that when they leave high school, they're actually ready to enter straight into college-level courses. However, in the event that that does not happen, there needs to be a safety net to be able to catch these students. Life is not perfect, and no one is perfect. So there's going to be someone that falls through the cracks, unfortunately. And so how do we stand up and say, as a system, we will catch you even if you slip through our cracks?
Thank you, Representative Erickson. All right. Thank you so much to both of you for presenting testimony. And we'll keep rolling here with our next testifiers, but we appreciate you being here. And committee members, I would just note, I've had probably three or four other folks asked to testify today. We are going to get into a significant time crunch if we do questions, and I hate to cut members off. But what I would like you to do is if we can try to hear from as many of the testifiers who are here today as possible. If we've got time at the end to do some questions, I'd like to do that. But also, you know, offer your feedback to me. If you want to do another day and invite the public in and interested persons to testify, we can see if we can work that into at least part of a day next week. Or also ideas for full committee hearings on particular topics that have been mentioned. So I would welcome your feedback on that once we're finished with the testifiers today. So with that, I have a representative from Somali Youth Association. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right. So please state your name for the record and provide your testimony. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you so much for having me. My name is Mohamed Farah, and I am the executive director of KJOG, which is a Somali youth organization agency here in Minnesota. The word KJOG is actually a Somali term, and it means to stay away and stay out. And the message behind that is to get young people away from all negative influences, such as drugs, youth violence, radicalization and recruitment, and what have you, and really put them in the right direction, which is education, making sure that they graduate from high school and getting to and are attaining and pursuing a higher education. We have various different programs. I'll talk about them very just a few minutes, maybe a minute. One of our core programs is an after-school program, after-school mentoring program that includes 4-H Club. 4-H is a STEAM focused, so science, technology, engineering is the focus, and this is in partnership with the University of Minnesota. We have a chapter with Boy Scouts. We also do a lot of artwork to engage young people, because art is part of the Somali culture. As you may know, Minnesota has the largest Somali population here in Minnesota. We've got well over 100,000 of Somalis. They're not just in the Twin Cities. They're dispersed across Minnesota. And as you may also know through various different media, that terrorist organizations have been recruiting within the Somali community. Over the years, there has been well over a dozen of young people that have been recruited, most recently with ISIS. And we know that radicalization doesn't happen overnight. This is a process. It's lack of education, lack of mentorship. It is a disconnect between the two generations. This leads up to isolation, which then in turn leads up to radicalization. Kajuk is partnering with the U.S., with the Minnesota U.S. Attorney Office here and the White House on a pilot program in Minnesota, L.A., and also in Boston to really tackle this issue of recruitment on a community level. Multi-level of government is cooperation is needed, and financial assistance is also needed for this effort to really succeed. During this legislation, we will be seeking a $4.3 million outreach across the state. We've had very successful programs and outreach within Twin Cities, and we would like to expand that across the state. And including this amount, and with your help, we are seeking $1.9 million for state outreach through education, through after school, through various different workshops. This is an ideology fight. We have to fight this ideology with an ideology through education. This issue is not particular to the Somali community. This is a Minnesota issue, and we really need to come together and really tackle this across Minnesota. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Ferrer. We very much appreciate your testimony today. All right. Next I have Minnesota Community Education Association, followed by Minnesota, I better put my glasses on here, Minnesota Association of School Administrators, Minnesota Association of Business Officials. All right, welcome to the Education Finance Committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Al Ickler, and I'm the Executive Director of Community Education for the Robbinsdale Area Schools. Robbinsdale Area Schools serves all parts of seven cities in the West Metro, Robbinsdale, Crystal, and New Hope, and parts of Brooklyn Center, Brooklyn Park, Plymouth, can't forget, and Golden Valley. We have about 100,000 residents that we serve and about 13,000 students. I am not an experienced testifier. I wanted to read my thing. However, you heard from Ignite about after-school programs, and that's what I'm here to talk about, is the after-school programs that are delivered through community education across the state and kind of the challenges that we face with them. And I don't want to repeat some of the things that Ignite said about their value, their impact. We are actually MCEA, the Minnesota Community Education Association, which I am a member of and kind of representing today. We're a member of the Ignite After School Alliance, and we fully support and believe that their message is accurate and that we're behind them. We would just add to that conversation, not compete with that conversation. So she talked about the value of after-school programs and the results that they bring. And we know that through after-school programs, meaning Saturdays and weekends and all that, that we help our student learners and we help the K-12 system support students by building relationships in those programs between adults and the student and between students and other students. We promote high levels of student engagement. We allow students to pursue a mastery of skills and knowledge around areas that they are interested in and truly engage them in learning. And we provide a structure, but we also allow autonomy through after-school programs and choice making. So those are important things in youth development, and those are important things in school success. And in the end, she talked about the results that come out of after-school programs. And we know that, in particular, the most benefit comes from our low-income students because they have the least opportunity to participate. And we believe that, and we are interested in finding ways to engage more of our students and families. As far as results, I would simply ask you to think about your child or your grandchild and what after-school program they participate in, whether it's through community education, it's through a youth association, it's through a sports association. What value around learning do you see when they participate? How do you see them engage in learning in a different way than if they hadn't participated? And that's really what we're talking about. We know the value to these programs in youth development and in school success. So community education delivers after-school programs across the state. Oftentimes, they're kind of disguised learning, and the students don't fully realize it. For example, I asked one of our coordinators, you know, what kind of STEM things did you do last summer in summer programs? She gave me a list including things like crazy chemistry, robotics, Star Wars, battle droids, whatever the heck that is. Eggs and bricks don't mix. And there's a long list. Finding ways to engage students in learning around areas of interest without them getting turned off because they're pursuing a passion that they have. In 2003, community education for the first time received an after-school enrichment levy. It was $1.85 per resident up to 10,000 residents in the district, plus 43 cents for every resident after that. So in Robbinsdale area schools, we serve 13,000 students. We receive about $56,000 annually toward after-school enrichment. That's about $4 per student. I think the policy at the time behind it was to have a little bit of public support and tie that in with parent fees, and that, you know, that public-private, meaning parent partnership, makes a lot of sense. And it continues to make a lot of sense. However, I think we would ask you to think about a couple things as we go forward in the legislative session. One is that over the 12 years, inflation has significantly eroded our ability in the school district to be that public support piece and keep costs low for families. 12 years is a long time. And secondly, we have far more of our families and students that can't afford to pay. Our free and reduced count in Robbinsdale area schools in 2003 was about 20%. It's now over 50%. So what we realize is that at schools and the communities, because we serve multiple communities that have many low-income families, we really need to be offering programs for free or very, very, very low cost. And we have been reticent to do that without a sustainable funding source. Going forward, like next summer, we are offering a two-week camp called Camp Invention. It's a science program. It's going to have 110 kids. It's going to be free. The need is so high in our community and in communities across our state. But now that we're going down that path, I guess we would ask that we find sustainable ways to keep that going. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Eichler. Appreciate your testimony. All right. And next we have the Minnesota Association of School Administrators.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Deb Henton. I'm in my eighth year as superintendent at North Branch Area Public Schools. I'm also the chair of the Legislative Committee for the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. I believe you have in your packet a card that looks like this. And if you look at the back side with the kids pictured, I will just go talk to you about the left side of that card and talk to you about the funding request that the Minnesota Association of School Administrators is making before you today. We would like to see an increase in the general education formula by at least $300 per pupil unit. As you know, we have all suffered from very difficult financial times, and our per pupil funding has not kept up with the inflationary rate, and so it has been very difficult for us to provide sustained funding for our schools. We are all in the midst of our budget process, believe it or not, already, and we cannot predict from year to year how much the increase may be or may not be. And so if we could have a sustainable source of funding that we can count on and rely on as we work with our school boards and our communities to set our local budgets, that would be a very good thing. I can tell you also that by increasing the general education formula, that would be equitable across the state. It would also give local control and local authority to the school boards to make the best decisions possible for their communities. You've also heard the theme earlier mentioned by other speakers about the facilities revenue reform that we hope we could see in this session. We know there was a study that revealed the inequities across the state. Most of the school districts in the state do not qualify for alternative facilities funding. Only, in fact, 25 of the largest school districts in the state qualify for that funding. So many of us in outstate Minnesota have buildings that are in very they're in a state of disrepair. We have only so much funding that we can spend annually on deferred maintenance, and we're struggling in that area, so we could really use some help and support. We also have technology needs that are just increasing exponentially. Those of us that have either little kids or grandchildren know that they come into schools already being able to swipe
They know about technology, and that is their world. They're digital natives, and we need to make sure that we keep up with those technology demands on a regular basis. And so, again, if we could have these funding streams available for all kids and equitable across the state with some indexing for inflation, that would be very helpful. And then, of course, we have the mandates that come out of each legislative session, and so many times they are such wonderful things like teacher evaluation. We need to do that. We need to make sure that we have high-quality teachers in front of Minnesota's kids who deserve nothing less than the best teachers. But it's a costly system. Some of us are QCOMP districts, as you know, and some are not. And thankfully, the legislature put into place money last year to help those school districts that we're not QCOMP school districts, but that money is one-time money, and it's going to go away. The need for teacher evaluation will never go away, and so there is a cost to it, particularly in districts that don't have a lot of administrators in outstate Minnesota. They have, you know, very few people to rely on in their districts, and so there's a cost. You have to bring in additional staff to help with that. And finally, I would say early childhood programming. We know that that is one of the most opportune time to teach our kids is during early childhood. We're grateful for the scholarship opportunities that were given to many school districts across the state, but not all qualified for those scholarship opportunities, and those scholarship opportunities don't provide universal school-based early childhood education, which we would like to see for all of Minnesota's kids. It would, we believe, go a long ways in closing the achievement gap that we know we all must address. So with that, I'll end my presentation, and thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the ability to speak before you today.
Thank you so much. We very much appreciate your testimony. All right, and next we have Minnesota Association of School Business Officials. And please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Pine. I'm the Director of Finance for South Washington Schools. And I'm here representing MASBO, which is the Minnesota Association of School Business Officials. And at the risk of sound like a broken record, since the superintendents are our bosses, we're basically saying about the same things. No, and nope. We do have a handout, I hope. And I'm an accountant, I'm not a public speaker. I'm sitting down, I can't look at my shoes, so I don't know what to do. As business managers, you know, we're focusing on what you would think we would, money, rules, and buildings. The formula, the basic funding formula is the financial engine for all our school districts, and it's what we watch every year, every day, and look for big changes. We'd really like to see that indexed to some kind of inflationary figure, whether it's a CPI or the implicit price deflator. And to echo what my predecessor said, I mean, we need to see some kind of index so that we know how to plan. We're looking always at 5 years rolling forecast. We're always looking ahead to see what's going to happen. Our school board members want to know what needs to be cut, what doesn't, how does it look in the future. And a lot of times we just have to sit, well, we have to wait and see what the index will be, what the formula will be. In the last 10 years, it's fallen down about $340 behind inflation. And that's per kid, per pupil unit. What does that mean? Well, in our district, you know, I spent the last 5 hours before I came here, we're agonizing over $8 million in cuts. And $340 over the last 10 years, I mean, that in our district, that would be another $6 million in revenue. It would soften the blow. We're not extravagant. We like to put programs in place that are valuable to our kids and expand to all kids, and the money's just not there. It's probably the worst part of my job. I have a great job. I love seeing kids get off buses. I love talking to principals and teachers and seeing them excited about programs we have in place. The worst part of my job is having to cut those programs or be part of that process. We'd also like to see the school boards be allowed to renew existing operating referendums on a year-to-year basis. Just the cost alone of some of these elections, it could be worth, you know, a half to a full teaching FTE. And our school board members feel that, you know, voters that passed it, of course, we'll be willing to have a subject to reverse referendum, but just convenience and the ability to renew on a year-to-year basis. I'd like to see the staff evaluation systems put in place to be fully funded if we can. and we'd like to see the successful college and the schools program fully funded. As far as the buildings go, we have members of our Madisville people on the Facilities Funding Task Force, and they came up with 8 excellent recommendations. And from what I've told, last year, about two and a half were adopted, and we're very grateful for that. And we'd like to see the rest of them become adopted, and we feel it's a wonderful source of funding for our facilities. You got to remember that school buildings are basically the backbone of every community. I started out in this business in a community of 5,000 people. Everything revolved around our school buildings, and we do our best to keep them up. Some discrepancies in how they're funded, and some advantages we can take using lease levies and health and safety dollars, and we just like to see that stuff tightened up a little bit. And I'll leave it at that. You have our trifold, and thank you for your time.
All right, thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. And let's see, next up I have Minnesota Association of Alternative Programs. Following that, Education Minnesota. I believe a parent representative from Parents United would like to speak. And then Association of Psychologists and Academic Health Centers. So in whichever order you all want to come up is just fine with me. So, all right, are you Mr. Allen?
I am.
All right, so go ahead and introduce yourself, and please proceed.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Steve Allen. I'm the Executive Coordinator of Minnesota Association of Alternative Programs. Alternative programs consists of alternative schools, area learning centers, and some charter schools throughout the state of Minnesota. And we've been in existence for 32 years. What I would like to do is quickly go through our platform, and I'll do it rather quickly because I know your time is of essence, and try to emphasize the points of finance that are important to us. And as you see in our handout, the first one is alternative assessment. And we've been looking at trying to get multiple forms of assessment for at-risk kids for a long time. This is nothing new for us. Relevancy and authenticity to our students is very, very important. And the transformation process of changing an at-risk kid just doesn't happen with a snap of your finger. It takes time, and transformation is real as you watch kids evolve and watch kids change their behavior, and it's pretty exciting to be involved in that process. The second one point bullet is our extended time revenue. Our extended time revenue is very, very important in that transformation process, in increasing graduation rates, and also in watching us try and attempt to change, to improve our kids' academic scores. The 2010 Legislative Auditor's Report was one of those things that said we did quite well, and it's very important to our school. A couple years ago, the extended time revenue was taken away from some of our charter schools. We want to see that reinstated for charter schools that serve a significant portion of at-risk kids, just like the area learning centers do, just like the alternative programs do. That's very important, again, in trying to increase graduation, increase performance for students. The third initiative on our thing is a bill that Representative Bly introduced last year, 124D.085. I like to call it our legacy bill. Reform doesn't happen just by alternative programs. So reform doesn't happen just by charter schools. Reform happens by those great superintendents outstate, those great superintendents and principals in the cities. Reform can happen anywhere. And what this bill did, it allowed us to encourage innovation regardless where it is. And I call that synergy. And if we can get everybody trying to look at that, not just in the alternative arena, it's not unique just to us in our field, but and we've talked to superintendents about this who really welcome change or welcome trying to do things differently. The one piece of that bill that we would like to encourage is to take away the word encourage and try to put required by 2017 or required by X date, to encourage at least one alternative initiative in every district. The last thing, the priority is the funding for over 21. We are very excited about the new bill for the adult diploma program that is coming along and is in a pilot state right now. But
The reality is we have a lot of schools like Guadalupe that over here that have a lot of immigrant students who need more time. And a lot of our schools are running their programs on their, without any generated revenue for these students. And so that's a very, very important issue for and then finally, the teacher licensure. We've been started working with Aaron Doan over at the Board of Teaching trying to get an interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary license to help work with our students across discipline areas. That's it. I think I cut it as short as I could. Thank you.
You did a great job, Mr. Allen. We appreciate it. Thank you so much. All right. Next, we have a representative from Education Minnesota. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
All right. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jody Boer. I'm with Education Minnesota here today representing our 70,000-plus educators in the state. And I know time is limited, so I will be brief and skip a lot of the details and identify for you the four main areas that we will be focusing on this legislative session. First, I want to let you know that our members are very concerned about the living conditions of their students and how that is affecting their learning. This summer, we had a poll conducted to find out what our educators considered the biggest challenges facing their students. Three of the top issues identified were, and I have a handout, and you have a summary of the survey results that's being handed out. Thank you, Pages. Three of the top issues are poverty, untreated mental health issues, and hunger and malnutrition. To address those issues, we are going to be seeking funding this year for the expansion of a concept called full-service community schools in Minnesota. Some of you may know this as really the best way to describe it is an extension of what you may have heard called wraparound services in the past. But it's broader than that. The concept puts social, medical, and supplemental academic services where they are the most accessible, on the school campus. The holistic student-centered services offered at Brooklyn Center Schools are the best example of this approach at the high school level in Minnesota. And we have Myers-Wilkins Elementary in Duluth, which is the best example of an elementary school that is already doing this. The initial funding we would be seeking is for a position called a site coordinator, whose job would be to assess the specific needs of the local students and the communities, the parents, and then to develop and manage partnerships with agencies and organizations who are available to help address the needs of those schools and our students. To be clear, while these services would be based at the school, they would be mostly provided through long-term strategic partnerships by outside agencies and organizations seeking to serve students, families, and communities. And just as an aside note, I was happy to, I guess, going last has its advantages, Madam Chair, committee members, to hear from a number of stakeholders who went before me who talked about some of these very similar concepts. So I look forward to having partners in this idea. Second, in the E12 budget, we support increasing the per pupil formula to match inflation at the very least. We would also ask the legislature to expand access to early childhood education provided by licensed educators in public schools. Additionally, as you've heard mentioned before, we too are going to ask you to address the unfunded mandates created by the 2011 TDE law, particularly in districts without access to QCOMP funds, as you've heard talked about. Third, we support efforts to make post-secondary enrollment more affordable and accessible for all students. And finally, Education Minnesota supports a reduction in standardized testing, and we will actually be putting forward a proposal around that. There are really three things that we're going to be looking at around testing. One is we are supporting federal legislation that's called grade span testing, and it seeks to reduce testing for reading and math, and proposes that we test kids in third and fourth grade, middle school, and at the high school level once in those subjects. We also are following closely and have members on the MDE Test Reduction Task Force, so we'll be looking for proposals out of that and hopefully that we can support. We'll also be putting forth a proposal that limits the quantity and addresses the timing of when our EL students are tested. We think that's very significant. So in closing, Madam Chair, I just again thank you for the opportunity to outline our priorities, and we look forward to working with all of you in the days and weeks ahead on these issues. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and I know we'll be working closely on all of those things. So Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To Education Minnesota, when you conducted the survey, did you ask any question about teaching effectively, you know, about the classroom and learning? Did you ask any question like that for the survey? Because these seem to be the issues that are underlying, but not the main issue, which is teaching and learning.
Ms. Barr.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, this particular survey was very focused on asking the teachers. In fact, if I could just point you to the handout for a minute, we actually included the specific language of the question that was asked for this particular survey on here. And it was really to ask our educators, what are they seeing as far as the factors impacting their children the most at this time? So that was what we focused on for this particular
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you, members. If we are all in it together, we can get the last two in.
I'll try to hurry.
2:30, so.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and representatives. My name is Ann Hobby, and I am project manager and now a policy fellow with Parents United for Public Schools. And I just want you to know, we just want you to know who we are today. We are a nonprofit. We've been around for about 12 years. And we have a pretty simple objective, which is to make what you do here in education policy accessible to the parent public and not so scary and maybe not so confusing. So we do that in a number of ways, and we're passing out a handout that says how we spend your money. That's how we spend our member money. We have about 70% of our funding comes from individual members who give us a dollar to, you know, to $500, however many dollars. I think our average is about $10 a month. We don't deny our services, however, to anybody based on need. We, among other things, you'll see what we do on that sheet, but we are here, and we just try to translate complex ideas so the public can understand what we do. We are... Let's see, we have members across the state. We produce an update every week about what's going on here at the legislature, and we have about 6,000 people who subscribe to that in all 134 legislative districts. So, we just are really interested in hearing from parents and getting parents engaged in this process so that the public is part of public education in Minnesota and we can have the best quality schools as possible. And we look forward to having conversations with you. I would love to meet you individually, love to connect you with parents and help the parent voice be heard in this conversation. Thank you.
All right, thank you. We appreciate you being here, Ms. Hobby. All right, Ms. Lee, please go ahead and introduce yourself and proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Jean Lee, President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International, R&R Family Centers, and I head APAC, which is the Asian Pacific American Housing Consortium. However, because we also have global connections, we're thinking of calling it the Atlantic Pacific Alliance and Housing Consortium, and I'll get into that in a minute. I have over 50 years in housing development and services, 28 years in education, economic development, healthcare, legal advocacy, social services, victim services, and veteran services. So you might say it's kind of the wraparound services that they were talking about. I've also been a Fortune 500 corporate auditor, and I've done grant reviews and for funders and some of the government agencies, both in program and financial audits. And so I wanted to talk about... 50 years ago, or over 50 years ago in Hawaii, where I came from, they were already working on accelerating student education, where kids could skip grades, they could change the environment, so we had different learning environments to help foster growth and different kinds of curriculum. And during that time, even in the 60s under President Kennedy, people were thinking of the space age, so we thought by now... would be having trips to other planets. And I mean people trips rather than unmanned vehicles. And so I've had talks with some of the astronauts, and like Buzz Aldrin has a 2040 plan, which needs the people who are highly educated and skilled to be thinking of the futures and the possibilities. I've also been a part of the late President Pro Tem of Congress, U.S. Senator Dan Inouye, who's a relative, and his collaboration with the United Nations and other countries in putting together the Millennium Young People's Congress back in 1999 to 2000. And we did continue it on because then 9/11 happened and so forth. As part of the collaborative, we had the Prince of Morocco involved, who's now King of Morocco, okay? And we also had connections with, you know, the princes of the United Kingdom. I just wanted to talk about, and you probably already know about the special students that rise to media, like the concert eight-year-old concert pianist who worked with Archbishop Tutu, who was a Nobel Prize winner, and the recent 14-year-old who was a prize winner in Malawi. And also you've seen kids on Shark Tank, and you've seen kids on Trump's Apprentice. So we know kids can accelerate and learn fast. We just need to give them the tools. As you think about, and Minnesota businesses think about competing in the global market, we know that some of the other countries are also wanting to compete against the U.S., and they have a different kind of system and are moving in different directions to move their people faster. Minnesota businesses, many of the smaller ones, are getting over 50% of their revenue in through exports. And the other thing is in the new invention areas. Now, you folks think, well, we need pathways to educate kids so that they could get good jobs and be in these manufacturing, versus some of these kids are ready to start companies themselves and be in the position of hiring others. And some of them, even at the college age, have done so. When you talk about world-class education, you also have to be thinking of different curriculums that will move people in that direction or kids in that direction. We're working on something with a number of other partners in that area. When you're talking about world-class workforce and entrepreneurs and businesses competing globally, you need to be thinking about the partners. And we've also, through this education, which I've come back to as far as we've found other new partners to work in this area. But we also have to think about alternative pathways for educators and students and changing existing laws that and laws and process, because I've seen some of the legislation and process, that create barriers to the changes that are needed to move us in this direction. And we also have to relook at some of the different certifications, and I'm talking in other fields and licenses, where students can really make a difference, and you'd be surprised that they could do just as well as we do. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Lee. I appreciate that. All right. Well, I thank all the testifiers and the members for cooperating that we could get all of those testifiers in today. We appreciate all of your comments and suggestions to the committee. As I've indicated, many of them are the start of longer conversations to come. So with that, we are adjourned for the week, and I thank all of you for being here.